the Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
I want to welcome you to this virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia, and I want to welcome particularly those members of the public who are listening to the court and the lawyers on an audio feed. The clerk will call the first case.
Grayson et al. Versus Westwood Buildings and Kubley et al. Versus Westwood Buildings. Bernard J. DeMuro, Michael S. Lieberman, Appellants Counsel, Matthew D. Ravencraft, Louise T. Gitcheva, Appellees Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to split 15 and 5 with your permission, Judge Justice.
Split 15 and 5 with whom? Mr. Lieberman?
No, this is Ben DeMuro. I'll be arguing.
The whole thing?
Yes, sir.
All right, so you want to reserve 5 minutes?
Yes, sir.
All right, thank you. You may begin.
All right, thank you. I represent Victor Kubley and his law firm, Kubley & Associates, as well as Alan Grayson and his two former law firms and a business trust. This appeal involves millions of dollars of awards, attorney's fees, and sanctions against all of the appellant for fraudulent and voluntary conveyance and diversion. The facts are lengthy, and I know that in the briefs. Let me simply try to summarize them as best I can. Mr. Grayson had a law firm in Northern Virginia for 18 years before he was elected to Congress in 2008. Over the years, he subsidized the law firm with $2 million up to and including 2008 as he engaged in complex contingency litigation. This created an indebtedness from his law firm to him. Mr. Kubley worked for him for many years. When he became elected to Congress, he sold the business to, or the law firm, to Mr. Kubley. And that via a buyout agreement, that indebtedness was part of the transaction. Kubley also took over the rent obligations, which had begun in 2007, I believe. Kubley struggled and borrowed another $1 million in 2009 from a trust that Grayson directed. So by 2009, Grayson's out $3 million via personally or his trust, and those are obligations of Kubley and Associates owed to Grayson's first law firm or to the business trust. In early 2009,
The trial court seemed to be skeptical of the factual allegations and pointed to, for example, the absence of supporting documentation and so on. So if you're right that all those loans were made and proved, then you're a senior creditor. But if the trial court found this fact or didn't accept the testimony that those loans were made or the amounts weren't proved, then where does that leave us?
Well, I would point out that the accountant for the landlord, the expert for the landlord, confirmed those amounts. So I do not believe there's any real dispute of fact in the record that those monies were transferred, and they're reflected on the tax returns as well. So.
All right. Because it seems to me there's a legal issue of UCC priority, et cetera, but then there's the factual question of what findings were made by the trial court and to what extent we have to defer to those.
Yes, but I would point out that those factual statements that I just made that are in the record remain unrebutted.
Okay.
Thank you. So in early 2009, Grayson took actions to perfect his security interest on behalf of himself for these amounts of money. Later in 2009, when the $1 million was transferred, he perfected the security interest as well. He used perhaps the leading commercial paper lawyer in Virginia, Gene Brown, for the last 40, 45 years. Kubley struggled, and in late 2010 and early 2011, he was delinquent on 7 rent payments. Grayson resumed the practice of law in early 2011 until some point 2012, while he was a secured creditor of a secured creditor. So the 3 transactions that the landlord complains about is $42,000 transferred from the first law firm to the second law firm. Also, $120,000 worth of settlement attorney's fees awarded in a settlement of a case. And then in 2011, Mr. Grayson began work for a company he had actually founded, IDT. And IDT's account had been cleared prior to the prior to him going to Congress in the first go-round.
On his testimony, or was there external proof? Because there was a factual dispute about whether the IDT work was based on this oral contract and was after he left Congress, so it was new work, or was it payment for fees generated prior, in which case maybe the landlord could claim some part of that?
I wasn't trial counsel. I believe it was based on Grayson's work, but if I'm incorrect on that, I will supplement the record or our comments.
Because I thought the trial court found that the work was, or the IDT work was for payments was for work done prior, not for work done subsequent to him resuming the practice of law.
I can't comment on that at the moment. Thank you. All right. So in April of 2011, the landlord took a consent judgment against Kubley and Associates, but nothing against Mr. Grayson or his first law firm. Then the landlord garnished Kubley and Associates' accounts. Grayson's lawyer intervened, and pointing out that Grayson was a secured creditor, nothing being hidden at that time. They engaged in discovery, at which time all of these transactions were disclosed. And many years later, the landlord claims that the 3 financial events were improper conveyances, and suit was filed in July of 2016. I'll begin with the conversion count that is only found against Mr. Grayson. Grayson was found liable in conversion because his attorney received settlement monies from the Quitom action in June of 2011 to pay off debts owed by AMG. The court found that the shareholder of AMG was liable for conversion. This is flawed in our belief, for 3 reasons. First, the Virginia Uniform Commercial Code provides that such an action is not illegal or improper. The UCC abrogated the conversion claims under the Citizens Bank case, which we cite. Second, as of that time, the landlord had no immediate right of possession of the settlement proceeds, as required by the court's decision in Universal CIT. And third, the landlord's argument that the writ of FIFA that the landlord issued to SunTrust Bank against Kubley and Associates somehow barred Grayson's lawyer from receiving the proceeds and dispersing them as partial payment of a debt in support of his senior secured position. The fraudulent conveyancing and voluntary conveyancing counts were were found as to all of the remaining appellants. They are void under this court's teachings under La Belladonna decision in 2017, which was cited by the landlord as controlling adverse authority to the court. First, all of the challenge transfers were made to pay a debt that the first Grayson law firm owed to Grayson, or which Kublian Associates owed to the business trust and AMG for other purposes, including the IDT payments. Payment of a debt is a valid conveyance in Virginia and not subject by other creditors.
Counsel, this is just Kelsey, if I may ask you this. Did the trial court have any factual findings suggesting that Grayson or the defendants acted with actual fraudulent intent?
No, in fact, quite to the contrary. We cite in our brief, the trial court found that Mr. Grayson did not set out to defraud the creditors. That's at page 15. The court found that Mr. Grayson believed his security interests were valid. The court found that Mr. Grayson did not exhibit malice or conscious disregard of the rights of others, and the court found that Mr. Grayson was simply mistaken.
If I understand your argument correctly, the trial court has already issued factual findings eliminating mens rea or fraudulent animus from the fraudulent conveyance case, and that leaves the trial court with the argument that, well, maybe the $2 million was never really given, maybe there weren't really loans, maybe really the buyout was illusory because there was no consideration. How do you categorize the trial court's application of fraudulent conveyance law in a situation where there's obviously not a voluntary conveyance, but there is a alleged factual finding that these contractual arrangements lacked legal consideration? How does that fit into the concept of fraudulent conveyance?
Well, there certainly was consideration because the monies paid by Grayson, the $2 million, and by his trust, $1 million, were advances to the law firm in return for the buyout agreement permitted a transfer of all assets and infrastructure. I think that's in a footnote. We go on at length in a footnote. So
am I right then that the core of the trial court's hold was the absence of legal consideration in the buyout agreement and some skepticism about the nature and the quantum of the payments Grayson made to AMC, as opposed to a finding that there were a lot of payments made and they were made with fraudulent intent in order to thwart future creditors?
Well, as we point out in the brief, in my world, having fraudulent conveyances for future creditors is an impossibility, a legal impossibility. The landlord, prior to Grayson leaving the law firm and transferring it over to Kubli and Associates, was current on the rent. Kubli was current on the rent for many, many, many months. When he started going delinquent, actually Grayson didn't know that.
The first rent payment was missed in October 2010, is that right?
October, November, that's right, late 2010.
Was it disputed below exactly when Grayson and his entities became aware, factually aware, of K&A's default on the rent and what the timing of that factual awareness was?
Grayson testified that he did not know for many months. Whether the other side
make factual finding one way or the other on that particular point?
I don't believe they did, or the court did.
Okay. Yeah.
So, because he was a senior secured creditor and there were no findings of fraudulent beliefs or intent under Labelladonna, the fraudulent conveyancing counts should be stricken. I also note that the statute of limitations, the court found that there was no statute of limitations for fraudulent conveyancing. We believe the catch-all statute of 2 years is the proper statute of limitations. There's an older case in Virginia that where the court found that the statute of limitations applied by the trial court was not in error. I've never heard of a claim that did not have no statute, civil claim that had no statute of limitations. We think 2 years applies.
On that point, why would it be the 2 year versus the 5 year? 2 years is injuries to the person, things like auto accidents, medical malpractice, and then 5 years injury to property. Wouldn't someone who interferes with your rights as a creditor, wouldn't that be damage to property as opposed to damage to the person?
I believe it's damage to the person, and it's also fraudulent conveyancing sounds in fraud, and I've forgotten the name of the case many years ago. I think it's Pinot, which said that if you apply the statute of limitations in which the claims sound in, and that was a dispute over whether or not the statute applied to the person statute applied or the fraud statute applied. We would say
but
that.
Then, even if it's 2 years, then there's a question of accrual. And I thought under the statute, accrual was when you knew or should have known. So that wouldn't that be a factual question that the court would have to resolve? I mean, I know your side argues by 2013, there was some discovery in connection with one of these lawsuits. And at that time, the landlord had everything to indicate what was going on. But since the court believed there was no statute of limitations, we don't have any finding on the accrual question, whether it's 2 years or five.
That's correct, there is no finding in that regard.
Mr. DeMuro, you're down to 3 minutes and 40 seconds. You can use your time any way you'd like, but I thought I'd remind you.
Thank you, Judge. All right. The trial court also improperly assessed in personam personal liability where the statute does not permit that. There are people found guilty of fraudulent conveyancing that didn't receive anything. There are defendants here who were not guilty of any receipt of anything. We call that vicinity liability in our briefs. Forgive me for a moment and try to shorten this up. We believe the record supports that the court applied the wrong standard of proof to under the fraudulent conveyancing and voluntary conveyancing statutes. There are a number of statements by the court that suggest that not only was he shifting the burden of persuasion or proof to the defendants, but also believed that something less than clear, cogent, and convincing evidence was necessary. As to damages, I've already made the point that that we believe everything he found to be improper is outside the statute of limitations for either voluntary conveyancing or fraudulent conveyancing. The court also rejected our claims for res judicata. In 2013, there was a judgment obtained against K&A, Kubli and Associates, and Grayson's first law firm. Anything that might have been litigated in this current case could have been litigated back in that case. So we think that res judicata under 1-6 and the court's decisions bars the proceeding. And then finally, with respect to awards of attorney fees and sanctions, We believe the court, the trial court, misapplied the law in that regard. MCR Federal states that in order to allow non-statutory attorney's fees, only if the case is a fraud case, where the fraud was a pattern of misconduct, of callous, deliberate, deceitful acts, and where the plaintiff had elected to proceed exclusively in equity. Rather, the court applied here the, or misapplied, we believe, the Prochaska standard as amplified in the MPR, MCR case. Further, the statute 55-8.1 sharply circumscribes attorney's fees under a fraudulent conveyancing claim by requiring four necessary conditions. That the transfer is declared void, which did not happen, had the intent to defraud, which was not found, the knowledge of the that the debtor had, the creditor had knowledge of the judgment, that participated in the conveyance. We believe none of these matters were found. Attorney's fees were also awarded against all eight petitioners or appellants, regardless of their liability, their existence as transferees, without consideration of what claims were successful or not successful. The fact that two defendants were found not liable, that three claims had been previously dismissed, the prayer for punitive damages had been denied. So there was a lack of analysis of attorney's fees. And then finally, as to sanctions, they were not pled. They were brought up at the last minute. There was no effort. The sanctions were $150,000. We believe that they are inadequately explained in the record. This was a...
Your time has expired, but we know your view from your brief.
Thank you, Justice.
You have rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead. Mr. Ravencraft.
Good morning. My name is Matt Ravencraft, and I represent the appellee in this action, Westwood Buildings Limited Partnership. First, I'd like to thank the Supreme Court and its staff for accommodating us in this manner, remotely, for these oral arguments. This is a novel for me, and it's a treat.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may ask you a question to get started, there's so many different factual questions in this case and very little time. The $1 million loan by Grayson to K&A back in 2009, as I understand it, you correct me if I'm wrong because I may have the facts wrong. The trial court did not say that that was a fraudulent conveyance, that it was based upon actual animus, fraudulent animus. Would you agree with me to that limited extent that there's no finding of actual fraudulent animus for the later payments based upon the $1 million GSA Grayson loan?
No, I would not agree with that assessment, Your Honor. And Justice Kelsey, there's a couple of things that you that I need to clarify. First is that there is no $1 million loan from Grayson in 2009. There's actually no loans from, the evidence is, and the factual findings of the court was that any and all purported loans from Alan Grayson at any time throughout the entirety of the history of the existence of its law firm, AMG or G&K, were non-existent, and we proved that.
I'm asking about the $1 million loan to K&A, not the $2 million in advances to AMG.
Okay, then I assume then that what you're referring to is what we refer to as the GSA loan proceeds that were advanced to K&A and the subject of GSA's confessed judgment. The trial, we demonstrated factually that GSA, the judgment creditor under that confessed judgment, did not loan K&A a dime. That all of the purported loans under this GSA loan structure were actually loaned by AMG, who is the other judgment creditor of Westwood judgment debtor of Westwood Buildings by virtue of our judgment. So that the court concluded was a fraudulent conveyance as well, because it was a it was an encumbrance of it of or charge upon the estate of Kubley and Associates that GSA received a judgment, a monetary judgment for over $1 million in exchange for no consideration. It was demonstrated that GSA did not pay Kubley and Associates any loans or any advances. And that all of these loans were made after the time that K&A and AMG had contracted for and were indebted to Westwood under the lease and the lease assignment. The confessed judgment was entered at a time when, after we had submitted notices of default to K&A and to AMG and to Allen Grayson, threatening suit. All of those are established badges of fraud, and that reverts back to your question, Justice Kelsey, posed to Mr. DeMuro, in which you asked, how does the court's lack of consideration determination, the trial court's lack of consideration determination, fit into the court's fraudulent conveyance analysis? And the answer is that lack of consideration or gross inadequacy of consideration involved in a transfer is a recognized badge of fraud. And we only need to establish one badge of fraud in order to prove a prima facie case of fraudulent conveyance.
I get that. Can I interrupt for another very brief question? But help me out conceptually. The badge of fraud concept, as I understand it, is merely a factual predicate for the inference of actual fraud. In other words, you see a lot of smoke, so the fact finder says, I infer that there's probably actual fraud here from this inference of the smoke. But as I understand it, and I've got a lot more to read in this case, but the trial court made a point of not attributing actual mens rea animus fraudulent intent. So correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Well, I think, first of all, the trial court, its comment with respect to the actual mens rea scienter or fraudulent intent was made in the context of declining our request for punitive damages, and that there was no malicious intent on the part of Allen Grayson or any of the other defendants which would warrant an award of punitive damages. That is separate and distinct from the proof of fraudulent, the intent to defraud under the fraudulent conveyance statute. And the intent to defraud under the fraudulent conveyance statute, as well established by the case law is proven by the recognized proof of recognized badges of fraud. And then once we establish that prima facie case showing the fraudulent intent or the intent to defraud, hinder, delay, or defraud the creditor, the burden then shifts to the defendants to present evidence to establish bona fides.
Does the burden of production or the burden of persuasion under your reading of our case law shift? Because the prima facie case is just a permissible
The burden of production. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. You go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. The burden of production shifts. The burden of persuasion does not shift. And I think that the court made it clear in its opinion letter, the trial court made it clear that it properly recognized, analyzed, and applied the applicable standards or burdens of proof in this case. Recognized that our burden initially in our case in chief to establish a prima facie case was with clear, cogent, and convincing evidence. That's the standard of proof that we have to adhere to establish a fraudulent conveyance claim. And that proof is established prima facie by presenting the badges of fraud, which we did. Then the burden of production, and the court emphasized in its opinion letter that it was only the burden of production, not the burden of persuasion, that shifts to the defendants to then produce evidence that would establish the bona fides of the transaction. And the court found that applying a preponderance of evidence standard to that, not a clear and convincing standard, but a preponderance of evidence standard to the defendant's burden of production, found that there was insufficient evidence to even bring the case into equipoise. The opinion letter itself clearly reflects that the court applied the proper standard of proof. Back to your question, one, and I don't want to belabor this, but I think the real answer here is that in connection with a fraudulent conveyance, the fraudulent conveyance statute does not require, it basically states that you can have a fraudulent conveyance if you prove the intent to hinder, delay, or defraud. There's not a prerequisite to actually proving actual fraud in connection with a fraudulent conveyance case. It is merely constructive fraud that needs to be shown in order to establish a prima facie case for fraudulent conveyance. I hope that answers your question. To get to the real thrust of this, and it harkens back to Justice McCullough's inquiry about the factual disputes in this case, and what the appellants seem to gloss over is the numerous factual findings that were made by the trial court and that were thoroughly explained in its opinion letter. And those factual findings were based on conflicting evidence. There was, for example, the question of whether or not the appellants of Mr. Grayson or GSA is a senior secured creditor, and the senior secured creditor status, which is the overriding principal assertion in their arguments was resolved as a matter of disputed fact, was resolved in Westwood's favor. And I say that because before you can be a senior secured creditor, you have to be a creditor. And if you're a creditor, the way that you're a creditor is that there has to be an existing debt. And what the trial court found after hearing all of the evidence, both the evidence of Mr. Grayson, weighing the credibility of the testimony of the witnesses, including Mr. Grayson, Ms. Coleman, and Mr. Kubley, that there was no legitimate debt in the form of any sort of loans from Mr. Grayson. The purported $2.8 million of loans of Mr. Grayson were completely illusory. And that was borne out not only by Mr. Grayson's own admissions, his prior letter to Westwood saying that AMG does not borrow money from anybody. And yet, 3 years later, or 5 years later, he turns around and says, AMG always borrowed money from me. And the tax returns of AMG, which do not ever indicate any loans from any shareholders or any other source.
Can you focus again back on the GSA $1 million transaction and security interest agreement with K&A?
Yes, sir. So that transaction was a transaction which generated by virtue of what was called the GSA loan. And the GSA loan was a loan which almost immediately after Kubley and Associates was created in January of 2009, it was never capitalized, and so it needed to borrow money. And GSA and Kubley and Associates entered into a loan agreement in which GSA basically recites that it will loan Kubley and Associates funds in order to continue its operations. And then what happened, though, was, and what the loan agreement recites is that GSA may not be the actual lender. The funds can from any commingled source, including Alan Grayson or any of his related entities. And that's what happened, Judge. What happened and what we proved was that, and what Carla Coleman testified to, was that none of the amounts that were provided to Kubley and Associates pursuant to the GSA loan were actually paid by GSA. They were all paid by AMG. And then a year later, when GSA confessed judgment, we challenged that. We challenged that confessed judgment because it was a fraudulent conveyance, because GSA, it was effectively a conveyance of a right to receive payment made by Kubley and Associates to GSA, even though GSA was never, even though Kubley and Associates was never indebted to GSA. There was
to give you a chance to address something before your time runs out. Assignment of error 3 from the alleges that the landlord's claims in this case are barred by res judicata because of earlier lawsuits that were brought by the landlord. What is your position on that? Why isn't that correct?
Well, the the prior lawsuits that they are referring to are the lawsuits that my client Westwood brought against Kubley and Associates and AMG and obtained judgments for breach of a lease, breach of the lease, and breach of the assignment of lease. It was effectively a breach of contract action or a breach of lease action against those two parties who we contracted with. The fraudulent conveyance claim that we brought against Mr. Grayson and all of the other appellants is not against the same parties, different parties, and it's not it does not involve the same transaction, conduct, or occurrence. It is completely unrelated to a breach of lease action brought against the tenants of Westwood's premises. And this case is completely unrelated in space as the analysis, by the analysis in Funny Guy, this case is completely unrelated. It deals with unrelated parties, and it deals with a completely unrelated transaction that is distanced so far apart in time, space, or
counsel.
Transaction.
It's a difference. It's the difference between getting the judgment and then later efforts to collect on that judgment, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, okay. Sir. And I mean that the res judicata argument would actually turn fraudulent conveyance law completely on its head. Fraudulent conveyance actions, time and time again, are brought and can only be brought after a judgment is obtained and after we're able to conduct discovery and learn about the shady dealings that have taken place in order to put the assets of that judgment debtor out of reach.
All right, Mr. Raymond, thank you for your
argument.
Sir.
Thank you.
Mr. DeMuro, what that 1 minute on the clock looked like was 1 minute left. That was 1 minute over your allotment of time. So you're out of time as well. Madam Clerk, call the next case, Coleman versus Westwood Buildings.